Hello, I'm Harry Glorikian, and this is Moneyball Medicine, the show where we meet executives, entrepreneurs, physicians, and scientists using the power of data to reinvent healthcare. From machine learning to genomics to personalized medicine, we look at the biggest trends in patient care and healthcare management. And we talk to people behind the trends to find out where data is making the biggest difference. From Amazon and Apple opening clinics to Uber launching Uber Health, technology giants are moving into the healthcare space. Many of these initiatives are still early, but they are already impacting the healthcare experience of many patients. My next guest is Peter Coffey. He is the VP for Strategic Research at Salesforce, where he has worked for 12 years to help both the company and its customers understand what they mean when they say platform. He has previously spent 18 years writing for publications, including eWeek, Computer Language, and AI Expert, and worked for 10 years as an AI applications analyst and a desktop computing manager at the Aerospace Corporation and in project management roles for various divisions of ExxonMobil. He has held various faculty roles in business analytics, IT management, and expert systems, and has lectured at Stanford, Caltech, UCLA, Harvard Business School, and the Sloan School of Management at MIT. Peter, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you. Good morning.
Peter, fantastic path that you've taken from, you know, writing and so forth, you know, to a company like Salesforce. How did you end up in this particular role? And what is the role specifically?
Sure. Well, I've been fortunate in my choice of random encounters over the last several decades. I wound up at Salesforce to work backwards. I, as you mentioned, began my work in a fairly straightforward trajectory. I came out of MIT with a civil engineering degree, went to work with what was then just plain Exxon, not ExxonMobil, in project management roles that took me to a lot of different places. And oddly enough, just about the time that I was facing the possibility of having to go to some place on the other side of the planet for a little while, another opportunity arose when they started talking about doing things that essentially looked like offshore oil platforms, which I knew something about, only in space. And that was the so-called Strategic Defense Initiative, which provided a bridgehead for me into a field I had not expected to be in, which was aerospace. And while I was in that domain, this desktop computing thing emerged kind of out of nowhere, where all of a sudden IBM entered the business, and the next thing you knew, there were five or six competing standards in the desktop computing space. And the company decided to get a handle on that and have one promoted standard, because there was still actually a question at the time about what that standard would be. And they did something quite interesting. They sent a VP down to the lunchtime user group meeting and took down the names of the four people who seemed to be answering most of the questions and said, okay, you people are the desktop computing standardization and integration team. Make them like it. And so we had the unusual situation of taking a company full of PhD engineers and having to find a way not to impose a standard, but to support a particular standard and set of options and configurations so well that they would find no good reason to do anything different. We absolutely had to do a demand pull, not a mandate push approach. And it led me to a lot of conversations about what it means to provide user experience, about what it means to lay out an architecture in which people feel that they can, you know, add and create new value. And I also had at one point there a chance to transition into a role that was more exotic, more technical in the area of AI applications development. This led to some opportunities to do some speaking and writing. And then at just the right time for me to be able to spend 18 years working from home while my kids were growing up, the writing opportunity came along. And as you've mentioned, I spent 18 years full-time in what was then the computer industry trade press, back when that meant a print medium. And that was when I met a fast track, obviously brilliant young man at Oracle named Mark Benioff. We worked across the table from each other, as it were. I coordinated competitive product evaluations for a trade publication, and he represented one of the often competing families of products. So imagine the relationship between the head referee and one of the coaches at the Super Bowl, and you have it about right. And he disappeared from my radar for a while. I did not follow the CRM industry, which was Salesforce's early focus. And so I knew of a company called Salesforce, did not connect it with my old friend Mark Benioff, until he called me in 2004 to say he was going to be in the LA area. He was actually receiving a Distinguished Alum Award at one of the schools where he had attended. And he wanted to know if we had time for breakfast. And I said, sure. And I wrote a column about the conversation that followed when we talked about the idea of taking all the stuff underneath the subscription model online customer relationship management product, for which Salesforce is still best known, and offer that as a platform license, the CRM with everything except the CRM. And we laid out a pretty ambitious agenda for what kinds of services that kind of platform would have to offer, not just the complexity and difficulty and skills requirements of traditional IT, but moved up into the internet. No, not that, but something that would take increasingly challenging tasks like mobile device support, high levels of security, internationalization of content, make those platform services. And you can figure out how difficult that was from the fact that it was 3 years later that I got a call after several other intermediate conversations saying, okay, we're getting ready to offer a platform license in the market. Would you kindly get yourself over here and help us explain this to people? Which led to the creation of my job of head of platform research at the time, which has since evolved into a much broader role, the VP for strategic research role, because Salesforce now is certainly well known for its CRM. It's a dominant customer relationship management product, and also has built a portfolio in service and support, marketing automation, analytics, and a number of other areas, plus the fact that there are 6 million applications running on that platform, most of which we did not write for ourselves. So this is how I wound up at Salesforce. And the next logical question about, well, you know, how do we play in healthcare is not quite an urban legend, because it happens to be exactly and literally true, but the justly famous configurability and integratability of the Salesforce platform dates back to something very near the earliest days of the company, when a CRM type system, something that manages the relationship with a customer from first contact through established business to, you know, long-time customer, well, that is an obviously useful tool for a hospital or a medical services provider to manage things like initial consultation, patient intake, recurring examination schedules, and things like that. Right. And it was established very early on. Hospitals do not call their patients leads or opportunities
yes.
or any of the other standard vocabulary of the Salesforce automation, as it was then called, space. And the earliest days of Salesforce began with the understanding that every tool we offer has to be capable of putting on the clothing, putting on the labeling and the vocabulary of the business environment in which it's being used. And so we have right. genuinely been in the front lines of patient experience management, healthcare efficiency, and so on, since very close to our earliest days 20 years ago as a company.
Right.
But it's what most people think of us as doing.
Yeah, and it's interesting, right? I mean, I've been interacting with CRM since I first started working, and, you know, first job was in sales. So your CRM could be your best friend if you use it correctly. But healthcare was never a relationship management business. It was a fee for service, and you made money whether you did something right or you did something wrong. And you know, if they came back, they came back. And if, you know, it wasn't to sell them something. They needed you. You were providing a service and you got paid no matter what, as opposed to, I think, what a Salesforce or a CRM is created for a traditional business, which is you're really trying to convince them to use you. It's a different model. And I think until the Affordable Care Act came about, where we started saying, we really only want to pay you for outcomes, did it start to turn to, Jesus, we need these people to be happy. How do we do that? Like, we need to measure things and we need to help them get to a better outcome. So, and what I find is now that the business is slowly turning, or the model is being shifted because of how people are being paid, technology now, or traditional technology for real companies, now starts to take on a much more important role, where you need to measure things and provide, quote, customer service to a population of, you could call them patients, you could call them customers, but that market segment. So it's, how do you see the system that you guys have created for healthcare superimposing itself into that world? And can you give me an example of how you guys are utilizing data to either better improve the, quote, customer experience, patient experience, or is there data that actually improves an outcome for a patient?
There's a saying, I don't know to whom I can attribute it best, that you can never change just one thing, or conversely, that massive change doesn't result from just one thing changing. It's when there's a triangulation of forces that something genuinely unexpected, but after the fact, obviously inevitable, happens. And there are a number of those things happening simultaneously in healthcare today. Number one, you mentioned yourself, healthcare used to be a very straightforward business. You dispense the pill, you perform the procedure, you conduct the office visit, you bill for input, you bill for the effort that was made, because conventionally, it was really not straightforward to measure outcome. Outcome happens somewhere else, some other time, maybe a period of weeks or months later. And meanwhile, you need to bill for the work you've done. And so the notion of fee for service, pay for pill, and so on was pretty deeply woven in there. Number two, the demographics. You know, George Friedman, not Tom Friedman, he's World is Flat guy. George Friedman over at Stratfor has observed that when you make bets based on demographics, you're really not predicting the future. You're just plugging a future value of time into the equation of now. And if you know how many 20-year-olds you have today, you got an excellent handle on how many 40-year-olds you will have 20 years from now. When you look at the changing distribution of age groups in the population, what used to be a pyramid with a very wide base and a very tiny tip of, you know, lots and lots of little kids and a few middle-agers and very few people over 65. And people don't realize that when the Social Security system was introduced, fewer than 10% of the population lived to be old enough to collect. It was not designed for a population that spends a third of its life being over 65. Now we're quickly approaching a point where we'll have roughly equal numbers of people in each of the 5-year slices of age from roughly 5 years old to roughly 60 years old. And that's a completely different proposition in terms of the scalability of spending and services in healthcare. I've heard various numbers to the effect that some enormous fraction, on the order of, you know, perhaps one half of Medicare expenditures, get spent during the last 6 months of people's lives. Well, that's not a sustainable situation. So you have that overwhelming force of demographics. Then you have the other overwhelming opportunity of massive increase in the amount of connective capacity available in the world. From 2007 to 2020, the amount of bandwidth available in the world from all channels, including wireless and telephone and wiring and computer networks, everything else, is growing by well over a factor of 1,000, which means that the ability to be collecting that data that we previously could not readily get of how's the patient doing, the ability to have a Fitbit type or an Apple Watch type device on a patient, that says, here's the behavior that they're doing. Here's the outcome that we're seeing. And now instead of having to schedule the office visit on a calendar basis, we can schedule the office visit on an exception basis. And we can use in-home technology. I can put a pH analyzer in your toilet. I can put switches on the doors in your kitchen. And they'll tell me, are you eating? Are you taking your pills? I can put a 25-cent chipset in the cap of your pill bottle. And now I don't have to take your word for it that you're taking your meds on time, because your pill bottle will tell me.
Right.
And
right.
All of that means that now the ability to measure outcome and effect and patient behavior is hugely increased. And so now we can start to, as you observed yourself, move in a direction of payment for result, not payment for effort. And then finally, you've also mentioned the legislative impact of the Affordable Care Act. In particular, the financial consequences to providers of patient readmission within 30 days of anything like hospital-acquired infections, which have been a significant problem, or preventable medical error, another significant problem. It turns out that when those positive feedback loops are introduced, remarkable things happen. The readmits have gone down. And it's not because we suddenly got smarter. It's because there were enormous incentives now to do things like put out little branch clinics that can handle things like flu shots. You've seen the statistics, I'm sure, on the degree to which income-challenged people wind up using the ER as their primary care provider,
right,
which is a horrible misallocation of resources. And when you create systems with feedback loops that make visible what's going on and that incentivize doing things that produce better outcomes, oddly enough, people behave in ways that produce those better outcomes. And so all of these things, demographics, technology, the legislative environment, these are triangulating to create an environment in which, to come back to, the, I think, the central point of your question, the notion of healthcare as the delivery of a client experience becomes the dominant view, as opposed to the notion of healthcare being an obscure profession in which only the members are capable of judging each other's work, and in which everything is, you have to do this because we say so.
Right. And but you're, what we're talking about, I mean, it is a profound shift in a business model and a way of thinking, which always worries me, because I'm not so sure the system is actually fully understands or appreciates what's happening. I mean, we're talking about, as opposed to sick care, we're talking about healthy care or preventative care. It's like the sensor in your car says something's wrong and you can take care of it before it becomes a problem, or, you know, a machine in a factory gets fixed before it has a catastrophic failure. And most of that care is not delivered in the ivory tower. It's going to be in the community. And so when I see deals like Aetna and CVS, I think about that and I say, well, if they really pull that off, right, they really don't want you going to the ivory tower.
Exactly.
If they can take care of you at that location, which...
Aetna and CVS, and also another interesting deal, Aetna and Apple, because Aetna is promoting and subsidizing the distribution and availability of the Apple Watch devices. You notice a very interesting pivot that occurred with the Series 4 release of the Apple Watch, which had the EKG capability. It was introduced and promoted not as much as previous versions have been as a fitness device, but as a wellness device, because everyone eventually becomes a customer for wellness devices, as opposed to the fitness device, which is a healthy market, pardon the expression, but a market of considerably smaller size. And then throw in the observation that last September, I think it was, John Hancock announced that after a brief period of experimentation, they were now going to have a blanket transformation of their policies in areas like life insurance, to the point that all such policies would include some provision for letting wearable device data inform their assessment of your risk and therefore your rates. And then finally, one more thing. These people have figured out something that most of us have known for a long time. We may not have known the technical term, but loss aversion psychology if you offer someone a chance to earn a discounted Apple Watch by behaving better, they may do it, they may not. If you offer them a free Apple Watch, but they have to start paying for it if they fail to achieve various promised levels of physical activity, diet, and so on, well, having to pay for something they had begun to think of as free is a much more powerful lever on behavior than offering a discount on something that they don't already have. And this is just wired into the human psyche.
Yeah, and that's interesting because I firmly believe that tech, doing A/B testing, understanding how to motivate somebody, add in a little bit of the marketing side of this, and all of a sudden, you may have ways of influencing somebody's behavior, whereas in the traditional healthcare company doesn't necessarily have that level of insight.
Well, not only did they not have the insight, but they really didn't have any incentive either, because if you didn't diet and you didn't exercise, you wound up consuming more procedures for which they would get paid. So what you have to do is shift the point of rotation to where the patient's health and the provider's incentives are aligned with each other instead of being at best at right angles to each other and maybe even pointing in opposite directions. And that is something that has happened, as I think we can accurately say, largely as an outcome of the legislative changes under Affordable Care Act, as much as anything else.
Right. And it, I find it, I noticed the shift. I mean, if you notice, there's the number of independent insurance companies is sort of dwindling very quickly. They're either buying or merging. Some are partnering with a provider, but you're seeing a whole landscape shift of the environment. So I would think, and I could be wrong, but products like a Salesforce for healthcare, where customer interaction, customer service, analyzing data from a customer becomes incredibly valuable. And a part of me believes that's not very far off from, say, adding clinical data, and then it's sort of becoming the next embodiment of an EHR.
Yeah, well, it completely is. And there are a number of interesting pivots that are occurring in that space. One of the problems that we have, our own extensive research. We have a document that people can download for free called the Connected Patient Report. I think it was last fully updated in 2017, because it's not one that we do every single year because it's a massive amount of research involved. But the degree to which people rely on their primary care provider to be the custodian of their records, to be the manager of their recurring appointments, 60% of Americans who have health insurance and a primary care provider tell us that they rely on their doctor to keep track of their records, and 28% of those patients keep their health records in a shoebox or a file folder at home. Now, the degree to which we can rotate that relationship to where patients have tools for keeping track of their health behaviors and resource consumption and outcomes, as well as most of them are using today such tools to keep track of their money, for one thing, the more we can move to a point where people own their health records and selectively make them available to providers, instead of your primary care provider owning your file and you having to ask them to ship it off to a specialist or whatever, make people the owner of that. Another thing that can happen is that people who don't want to do that themselves will look for someone who can do that, and maybe it won't be their primary care provider anymore. Imagine if the people that today we call health insurers, who are really more like risk aggregators and service payment managers. I don't really understand the use of the word insurance in this context, but the degree to which, instead of being a necessary evil of payment management, if they could instead become the primary custodian of your wellness, and instead of providers billing you through the people that today we call health insurers, the health insurer, I'm not talking about an HMO type model, but I am talking about a model in which your relationship with your health insurer becomes health outcome management. And now the people under their umbrella are not just the people that today we would regard as medical services providers. They might also include dietitians. They might include transportation providers, because the people who are the payers today, they know a lot about where the unnecessary frictional and error of process costs are arising in the system. People who miss an appointment because they're older, and we're going to have a lot of older people because they're older and their drive didn't show up. Well, we can, with three lines of code, embed an Uber button in your medical app so that right. if you get a proactive notification, you've got an appointment tomorrow. Do you have a ride? If the answer is yes, great. If the answer is no, a chatbot can lead you through a question like, do you have access to mass transit? Yes or no. Do you have flexibility on when you leave your home to arrive at the office? Yes or no. And you can wind up in a very efficient way booking something like the next generation of an Uber type capability that makes the rounds, visits the concentrations of where people are going to be leaving to where they are going, and dynamically manages that transportation in ways that reduce people's being late or missing appointments, which is an unnecessary, completely non-value-adding cost to the system. That's the right. kind of lubrication that data can provide. And it's not medical data. It's processed information.
No.
And so there's a whole lot of stuff we can do that's, if you will, in the penumbra shadow of the medical costs and yeah. time use in the country that can dramatically improve efficiency and drive down costs.
So if you know, if I jump back and, you say, carry your own data with you. I mean, I think, yes. In some ways, that Apple enabling carrying part of your record around with you, maybe not the whole thing yet, but is really sort of changed, if Epic and Cerner were going to be worried about anything, I would be worried about players like that, making it very, very easy for you to do it. And, for the love of God, we've been talking about standardization and being able to, move data around forever. There is no incentive for those players to do that. If I think about those platforms, it's like the old Microsoft code that had to eventually be rewritten so that it would, serve the modern age. It was a billing system as opposed to a patient management system. Regarding the insurers, I think of them the same way. Is the a traditional payer needs to morph dramatically. I mean, yes, they have information, but they've always been incentivized to push paper, right? The more, it's like the blackjack table, right? The more money goes back and forth, right? The more money stays with the house.
They're being paid.
It's not
for
necessarily. Exactly. And some of the things you mentioned, I think of like a Geisinger or an Intermountain Health, where it's an integrated health system where the healthier they keep you while you're paying your insurance, the more money they make because you're not using the system, but you're paying into the system. So, I mean, I see technology playing such an incredible role, and it's data analytics, data analysis, presenting it the right way to the person at the right time. And the other thing, one of the things I wanted to touch on was the one fascinating thing about a company like a Salesforce or an Apple or whatever is it's not like a standalone company. If you look at the existing medical organizations, companies, people providing either the service or the technology is they don't create ecosystems. And you guys and Apple and other people in tech create an ecosystem. So even though you come out with a product, if you want to call it that, or a platform, right?
That is what makes the word platform. And you were kind enough to describe my role as helping both ourselves and our customers figure out what that word platform means. And I would love to elaborate on that if you would like to hear that from me on that now.
I'd love to hear it, but the one thing I'd love to hear, for people to hear is it creates exponential change.
Yes. Well, it facilitates.
And that's
it.
New to healthcare.
Yes. There are a number of points there that you've just made. The word platform in the IT world has traditionally meant a vendor's highfalutin description of their product family, which has traditionally, if you were one of the large legacy providers, meant we make computers, we make operating systems that run the computers, we make a database engine that runs on that operating system, we make a stack of middleware that runs in that database environment, and for several hundred thousand dollars, you can ante up and start spinning the wheel, and maybe in a few years, you'll have built something that starts to return some value to you, and that was the traditional value proposition. That's not necessary, and it's not tolerated anymore because customers know that they can simply buy a subscription to our services. I've compared it to the difference between someone offering to build you an airplane or offering to sell you a pre-built airplane, and our model, in which you just beam up like the Star Trek transporter into an airplane that's already flying. And all of the difficult and expensive and risky things of construction, testing, and deployment, well, that's all done. And what we're doing is offering you a slice of our existing operating, running at full scale capability that can be labeled by you, differentiated by you, have new services and processes added by you. And that's really the nature of platform, because now people who know stuff that we don't know can take all of the things that we do know and immediately put them to work at scale with proven security and reliability and availability, and then quickly start to add their own distinctive intellectual property to that. So that's what the platform proposition really needs to represent to people.
Peter, but that has two profound waves that come with it. One is the pace of change can be very fast, right?
Yes.
If you think about, Apple Marketplace and all the apps that are on it. It's not 10 people working on it. It's hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people on a global basis.
All the world's
right? That's
smartest
one.
People work for me, but I don't have to write them paychecks.
Right. But it also super concentrates the capability into a much smaller handful of players and changes the dynamics. So, I can't speak to the level of experience you have in our world of healthcare, but where do you see that shift happening with all the players that you're talking to and where Salesforce wants to go? Where do you see the impacts in healthcare and where do you see it evolving to, say, in the next 5 years, which is a long time in tech?
It is. And it didn't used to be a long time in healthcare, but now it is also, because the exponential acceleration of change, as you've observed, has been affecting everything. Traditionally, the kind of thing I've been describing with the emergence of these massive platforms, including Salesforce, Apple, Google, and the like, would lead to a perception and a reality of concentration of data. And you had a sentence a few times ago when you said data, 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 and data, and you were exactly right with that level of emphasis. And a concentration of data would be a concentration of power, because traditionally, the person who holds the data can monetize the access to that data, and it becomes a situation where you have no choice but to trust them, and you have no choice but to pay the tolls. There is another phenomenon that's emerging today. It's unfortunately tightly coupled in many people's minds with cryptocurrencies, which are just an interesting use case. But the move from highly centralized collections of data, traditionally called databases, to distributed ledger type systems. The word most commonly used in that context is blockchain. That's just a special case. There are other platforms such as Ethereum and so on that do not require the placement of all trust and power in a single trusted authority, that do provide cryptographically, mathematically assured validity and integrity of data. One of the reasons that perhaps people might have said, well, you can't let the patient be the custodian of their medical records, because then they might lie. They might lie about pre-existing conditions. They might choose not to mention things that they prefer not to discuss with a provider, and you might have serious impairment of the validity and quality of care. Well, now we can have data architectures in which I, as the patient, do in fact have complete control of what goes in there, but I can't edit it. I can't alter it or obfuscate it, but I can make it available under my own control to providers. And this move from isolated citadels of data, occasionally, expensively, and in a fragile way, connected to each other through little, you know, bridges and tunnels. Well, no, now we can move to credible, scalable, secure, robust architectures in which I, as the patient or the patient's proxy, really can manage access to that data, but while maintaining provider confidence in the accuracy and reliability of that data. And so this is also an area where Salesforce has many partners. We do not yet offer something under our own brand, forward-looking statement that seems logical that we will do that sometime soon. The pivot in the data model is absolutely part of this picture to address the issue that you've just identified, which is that these massive platforms would imply a concentration of power, but new data architectures, in fact, put more of that control at the edge with the person originating and owning the data rather than less. And that's a really important keystone to that arch, because absent that, you would have all sorts of reasons why people would be justifiably apprehensive about this. But instead, when you put that final piece in, you really can move yourself to the point that we've been describing here, which is number one, demographically, we're all going to spend a lot more time being old. We're all going to have a lot more reasons why we're going to need continuing care. Look at the data. It shows that at some point in the last 5 years, things like heart disease and infectious disease and, you know, respiratory illness that used to kill people fairly quickly once they had them, well, those are pretty much being dealt with. And so now people are getting cancers and Alzheimer's and other conditions that require much longer periods of costly care. And most of us now are going to live long enough to need those things. Well, this requires a dramatic pivot in how we think about the scalability and the distribution of risk and so on across the population. We have the connectivity to measure tremendous amounts of information on behavior and outcome without the unscalable, highly expensive resource of office visits and hospital diagnostic tests and so on. And we have the data architectures that can give people more ownership and control. You put all of these things together and you have the necessity, the opportunity, and the capability to deliver the kind of transformational change that I think we all agree healthcare is ready to enjoy, really, for the first time in centuries.
Well, it's interesting that you use those choice of words, because I would say that I'm not sure that I can rattle off a name of people that are in healthcare that could do 90% of the items that you just mentioned. That really, it sounds like a tech-oriented company more than what you would look at as a traditional healthcare company. Although they're trying. They're trying to shift.
There's an axiom these days that every company is a software company. They only differ in their applications. I prefer not to think of it that way, because our job at Salesforce is to make the technology as straightforward as plugging something into the wall and getting electricity without needing to have an on-site electrical engineer. Right. And increasingly, we want the people who are your IT people not to be in the business of acquiring, installing, operating, and administering a technology stack, but really to be information and process people who spend their time designing a nursing experience, a practitioner experience, a diagnostic experience, a patient experience, and a caregiver experience. Because one of the least appreciated opportunities to make healthcare far more scalable is far better support for the people with aging parents, the people with young children, the people with a spouse or other partner who needs the kind of care that they haven't been able to get before. We're finding there's some tremendous diagnostic outcomes that result from patient support communities and access to any number of services. Just being able to let a caregiver, a spouse of an Alzheimer's patient, have 1 hour a week to go out and, you know, hang out with their friends or whatever, because you've built community referral systems where people can help each other out. These are relatively low-cost initiatives in an environment that has the kind of connectivity that we enjoy in social media and dating applications. And we can bring that same kind of fluidity into this marketplace at a time when it really needs it.
But Peter, if you think about it, right? I mean, I've been in sales and marketing roles in the past and et cetera. When CRM and these things came on, we adopted them begrudgingly in the beginning. But you know, now it's par for the course. I mean, you wouldn't even think about it. You're talking about a profound behavioral and process change in healthcare. Now, I'm excited, right? Because as a venture capitalist that's investing in the space, I'm looking for those companies that will enable that, that will be part of, say, the Salesforce environment, or Apple will want to, you know, acquire next, right? But it is a profound shift, and I find that talking to the traditional player doesn't always, they have a hard time seeing it. I always think about it like Kodak and digital. A lot of smart people, right? And the question was, but are they in the chemical space? Are they in the, you know, you got wiped off the face of the earth because of this shift.
Well, the reason that I and my team spend order of 200 days a year somewhere other than our desks is that we do need to get in the faces of people who have decades of experience in doing very, very, very well what they do now. And the human brain is highly inclined toward continued incremental improvement of existing processes and skills, not so inclined toward rotating the vector by 90 degrees and doing something genuinely different. And so we've built a lot of things here at Salesforce. You've said yourself that when CRM was first introduced, people accepted it grudgingly. I often say the biggest achievement of Salesforce's first 10 years was to get salespeople to see a CRM system not as an intrusive micromanagement and record-keeping tool, but as a performance improvement tool. And then we were able to spend the second 10 years dealing with the change in perception that comes from that. We do a lot of work with customers that is not selling them a subscription, but is providing free sessions that at various levels of complexity are called either Spark or Ignite sessions, where we say, this is going to be a technology-free conversation. We're going to be covering the wall with post-its here. We are going to be doing a forget all the assumptions that you've ceased to realize you're making and really look at the fundamentals of the marketplace in which you will be, the behavior of the customers you wish you had, the opportunities created by technology. But it's not a technology adoption challenge. It's a behavior change challenge. And a huge amount of the talent, blood, and treasure of Salesforce today is spent getting people to be interested in, capable of recognizing the necessity of behavior change, at which point we become a facilitator. But it's not selling software anymore.
Well, that I think is going to be the biggest shift for everybody in healthcare. And I enjoy it tremendously because I love the pace of change. Peter, I want to thank you for spending the time here today on the show. It was great having you. And I look forward to keeping in touch and learning more about what Salesforce and what you are doing in the future.
It's my pleasure. I would be happy to provide, by whatever means you like, online links to some of the resources I've mentioned here. For example, that connected patient study that I mentioned, even though it came out almost 2 years ago, I think it would still provide tremendous insight for people. In fact, if people just Google Salesforce connected patient report, I think they'll find the download link to that. And I don't want people to do this because I said so. I want to be someone who helps them see the world as it is, to see the data that makes these things necessary, and then help them connect the dots.
Excellent. Well, I will put that on the webpage for the podcast, and thank you, and look forward to staying in touch.
Great to be with you. Hope we can do this again sometime.
And that's it for this episode. If you enjoyed Moneyball Medicine, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It is greatly appreciated Hope you join us next time. Until then, farewell.